Vanguard Radio for the precious 8%.
I believe that your primitive cerebrum kept trying to wake up. Deep in the belly of the Quah. This is Jeff Beck. I'm your host for
The Truth Is No Defense.
Welcome to the broadcast. This is the 24th edition of The Truth Is No Defense. Stigma is a powerful weapon, freely available to white nationalists. So let's make use of it. Stigma is like hydraulic pressure. It is incremental, silent, and if applied with sufficient force, unstoppable. Name-calling is a form of stigma. When we use epithets like nigger, wetback, spick, kite, gook, mongrel, and mud, we're differentiating ourselves from the other. But more importantly, implicit in these slurs is the connotation of dirtiness, nastiness, and the inferiority of the other, since embedded in the meaning of these words is the force of stigma. In decades past, it was not so much miscegenation or apartheid laws, which kept whites and blacks apart, as it was the force of stigma, especially in the form of shame. Back then, it was understood that blacks were different from us. They were inferior. They were violent beasts, filled with the passion of reckless violence. And the elite in this country also understood such sentiment. They then wrote codes known as Jim Crow or polling tests or miscegenation laws to protect the white race. Even though the last of these laws was dismantled back in the 1960s, I can clearly recall, as a young boy, seeing heads turn in revulsion at the sight of a nigger with a white woman. Hence the power of stigma. Such gestures are important, since they keep people in line. They maintain a social code. Again, it's not so much laws that discourage people from, say, smoking or littering, as it is social stigma. People don't like to be the object of public scorn, dirty looks, and ridicule. White nationalists need to employ stigma. We need to revive our people's base instincts and feelings as situations present themselves. The visceral disgust we feel towards niggers and Jews must again be expressed in our body language and articulated by our speech. These elocutions don't have to be a prelude to violence. They can be subtle and displayed discreetly by looks, gestures, whispers, if need be. We should use these words among our own people to soften them up. Racial epithets, if used effectively, are perhaps the most powerful weapon in our arsenal of stigma. Latent in all white people is the feeling that non-whites are inferior and a threat. And indeed they are. Words like nigger and kike drill deep into the psyche The Jews, with their keen interest in psychology, know these facts. With their control of the media, Jews stigmatize whites who use such terms. But they don't stop there. In fact, the Jews, through the media, stigmatize the white race itself by telling us we are responsible for racial animosity, that we are responsible for black failure and black crime, telling us we are responsible for third world poverty. And since a white racial revival is always a possibility, the Jewish media repeat and repeat these stigmatizing messages, pummeling us each day in radio, TV, and newsprint, and even the movies. They tell us race doesn't exist, but more importantly, they tell us the white race doesn't exist. But folks, science is on our side, especially the science of genetics. We can use scientific facts to further our ideological message. Though, overall, I think that social stigma is a much more powerful weapon than science. But it's nice to have a few hard facts on our side to convince the curious but skeptical among us. For those whose vision is clouded, for those who cannot observe the chaos and anarchy caused by blacks, or the nation-wrecking scheming brought upon by the Jews, and from these observations make hard-headed, realistic judgments. In this case, a few scientific facts might be useful. Just this year, a new book about the science of genetics was released from a source many listeners might not expect, the science writer for the New York Times, Nicholas Wade. His book is titled, Before Dawn, Recovering the Lost History of Our Ancestors. Wade's book uses genetic science to map human evolution. An important revelation contained in Before the Dawn, one especially important for white nationalists, is documentation about ongoing human evolution. Wade shows that humans continue to evolve, to change, and this ongoing evolution is progressing along racial lines. That is, at some point in our past, the evolution of humans split along racial lines, different evolutionary paths. I'd like to play a clip from an NPR interview with Nicholas Wade.
Why do we all look so different and act so different, you know? What happened there?
Well, I think the answer there, you get into the previously murky subject of the genetic basis of race. Mm-hmm. So there's been what I would call a conspiracy of silence on this fight. The geneticists have not really wanted to say much about it. For good reason, they really didn't know very much until recently. The social scientists have much preferred to say, well, race is a social construct. It's not biological. There's nothing genetic there. And we're all diversity is cultural. So everyone's been sort of happy with that position. And they're good sort of historical reasons why we've taken that course. But now the geneticists at last are beginning to understand the genetic differentiation of the human population.
And
as soon as we spread out from Africa and started to live on the far-flung continents around the world, there was no longer any intermixing. Now, the genome doesn't stand still. It's mutating all the time. So this meant that on each continent, each population started to evolve independently of all the others and to respond to the local environmental stresses, whatever those were. It's hardly surprising that we do differ from each other in
And this about the Jews.
We're tracing the history of how divergence occurred in human populations 50,000 years ago. You talked about them being separating at the different continents and sort of inbreeding. Would that be the right way of looking at it?
Yes, that's right.
Talking about isolated populations, you mentioned in your book that the Ashkenazi Jews are a good example of an isolated population that has undergone many genetic changes.
Right. This was a surprise, but it's turned out from looking at the Y chromosome that the the Jewish men from many different Jewish communities around the world all have the same Y chromosome. Now, it's not specific to Jews. It's a sort of generic Middle Eastern Y chromosome.
Mm-hmm.
And it also is, it is proof not only that they all come from the same source, from the Middle East, but also that the community has interbred, and this obviously for religious reasons.
Right.
Although I don't think this result could have been predicted, I mean, because people can convert to Judaism if they wish, nonetheless, it has turned out that, at least until recent times, Jewish communities have been endogamous, or breeding within themselves.
Folks, the science is on our side. Of course, that doesn't change the fact that Jewish media is telling our people that race doesn't exist. And in the end, the public doesn't read books about science, but instead watches Oprah or listens to Rush Limbaugh on Fox News. Though, we can reach the disenchanted and the curious. And a few hard facts about science might help to bring them over to our side. Let me give you an example of what I mean, and it's something you can do to reach out to our people. While visiting a mall, I noticed a young white man, maybe 17. He was attending a small boutique store. He was clean cut, had short hair, a collared shirt, and a shaved face. Since the store was empty, I thought I'd chat him up, see if I could spread the ideology a bit. "Are you local to this area?" I asked. "Yes," he said. I told him when I was young, this mall sat on farm property and that my own father had hunted these very fields. He continued to listen, so I continued to talk. I told him that America back then was a lot cleaner and safer place. He continued to listen. Then I hit him. "You know, back in those days, we whites didn't allow blacks near our women. Doesn't it disgust you when you see a black with a blonde girl?" I asked. He shuffled a bit, but didn't say anything. Slowly, he replied, "How so?" "Well," I said, "these blacks are different from you and I. And we understood that back in those days. We didn't want niggers in our family tree. We didn't want them wrecking our genetics." "Really?" he replied. "Why, yes." I then rattled off a few facts about black violence, the size of nigger brains, and a few other facts about blacks. He seemed to absorb what I said, like a sponge. He just stood there silently. I noticed people coming in the shop, so before I exited, I said, "Look, if you have any sisters, or perhaps a daughter of your own someday, keep them away from the niggers." He then quietly said to me, "You know, I come from a small town, and we don't like that sort of thing either," referring to race mixing. Sure, this process is slow and cumbersome, but it does ratchet up the pressure to another degree. And since we don't own television and radio stations, person-to-person contact is one of the few methods we can use. But this also points to the importance of VNN, since an episode of Goify, for instance, might reach 1,000 listeners. Maybe that young man from the mall may hear Goify one day. It's hard to say. In this regard, let's recall a lesson from chaos theory. This mathematical theory states that even a small change in the initial conditions can produce a profound disorder within a system. This is often illustrated with an example of weather. According to chaos theory, a butterfly's beating wings might disturb the atmosphere in a tiny but significant amount, so that a thunderstorm might be generated halfway across the planet months later. Now, let's start creating some storms of our own. Thanks for listening.
Vanguard Radio, waking you up.